The Supreme Court today struck down President Trump's emergency tariffs, but they likely will not go away.
There are plenty of other ways that President Trump has to put tariffs on countries. He will within a matter of days, I think.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, the U.S. striking Iran is still on the table. We speak with Iranians preparing for the worst. And after a hiker left his girlfriend to freeze on a mountaintop, an Austrian court reaffirms a mountaineer code of ethics.
It was his responsibility to decide that they should have stopped.
Plus, U.S. versus Canada in ice hockey is all the talk at the Olympics. All that and much more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us this Friday. Carolyn Beeler is on assignment. She'll be back with us next week. We begin today with a long-awaited decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. In a 6-3 ruling, President Trump's emergency tariffs on foreign goods were deemed to be unlawful. Tariffs have been a central part of trade policy under the Trump administration. The president sees them as a corrective for what he's called the injustice of global trade. But tariffs have also been wielded as a stick in U.S. foreign policy over the past year, wreaking havoc across the globe. Ian Bremmer is president of Eurasia Group, an international consulting firm. We spoke right after the Supreme Court ruling came down earlier today, and I started by asking if this decision has simply eliminated all of Trump's sweeping tariffs worldwide.
There are plenty of other ways that President Trump has to put tariffs on countries. He will, within a matter of days, I think, impose tariffs under Section 122 of the Trade Act of 1974, and that allows a 15% tariff for like 150 days. He has other tariff mechanisms that he can put after that as well. But the IEEPA tariffs are gone, this idea that you can use national emergency to get around the fact that Congress has tariff authority and the president can put tariffs on anyone he wants at any level, that has been struck down. It should have been obvious that it was going to get struck down, and it means that literally overnight, we have gone from an effective tariff rate of about 14.5% to under 8%. And that's a big hit for Trump's authority.
Ian, remind us of the wide-ranging impact of these tariffs so far globally.
Well, the biggest two sets of impacts, one is that they have forced countries around the world to the table with America's asymmetric economic power over them. They've led to a whole bunch of trade deals, some of which have increased market access for U.S. goods into those countries, some of which have led to promises and commitments of major investments from those countries into the United States and important strategic sectors like the $550 billion that the Japanese made the announcement of, and now they're starting to actually put that money in play. So that's one set of things that's happened. The second set of things that happened is that the United States consumers have paid an additional tax. Most of that money that is coming into the U.S. government budget from the tariffs that is reducing the budget deficit in the United States, the hundreds of billions that the American government is collecting, those tariffs are being paid, of course, by the American consumer. And a fair amount of that money is now not going to be paid going forward. But there is no mechanism. There's no ruling from the Supreme Court on paying back the tariffs. That's going to be left for other lower level courts to rule on, which will surely happen over the course of months. And that's going to be very complicated.
As to the accounting, did the tariffs bring in the millions or billions of dollars that was promised?
Yeah, the tariffs have brought in all sorts of money. But remember, the promises were that that money was going to be paid by the foreign governments, and that's just not the case. And everyone kind of knew that. There was just a study that came out with the New York Fed last week that made very clear that the overwhelming majority of those tariff costs have been paid for by the Americans. There's a similar report that has been done by Goldman Sachs. There's others that have some work that's been done by the ECB. All of that has been very, very clear that the money that's being paid, which is bringing down the U.S. deficit, is being paid by the American voters.
Was there a political reputational hit for the U.S. in the eyes of other countries through these tariffs, and how significant has that been?
Well, the reputational hit is that the United States has had a series of agreed to trade deals that they've breached. So, I mean, you look at USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada agreement that replaced NAFTA. And when Trump was president first time around, he said it was the greatest trade deal that had ever been signed. And then he comes in president this time around and he unilaterally breaches the terms. Now, the Mexicans feel like they have no choice but to align with the Americans on this and give the US everything they can. But the Canadians have hit back pretty hard and they are working to diversify. That's why Mark Carney, the prime minister, went to Beijing and, you know, sort of reduced restrictions on Chinese electric vehicles coming into Canada. That's why he's trying to orchestrate a broader trade deal between the CPTPP, which was the Trans-Pacific Partnership minus the Americans when Obama couldn't get it done, and the European Union, would be the largest multilateral trade deal in history, wouldn't be driven if it wasn't for Trump and his unilateral orientation towards tariffs. So he gets credit for that, credit for diversification efforts of other countries away from the United States in terms of trade flows, supply chains, and the like.
So what happens now?
What happens now is Trump is going to quickly use other mechanisms to put those tariffs back on those countries. And there's going to be a gap. There'll be a number of countries that will see significantly lower rates than the rates they have right now as a consequence of this Supreme Court ruling, in particular China, India, Mexico, Canada, and Brazil. And, you know, China in particular, it's a pretty big deal because Trump is going over to China to negotiate with the Chinese on trade. And now all the fentanyl-related tariffs that the Americans have put on are now ruled invalid. So the Americans and Trump go to Beijing with less leverage than he thought he had a day ago.
I'm speaking with Ian Bremmer, president of Eurasia Group, about the decision today by the Supreme Court, 6-3, to strike down Donald Trump's tariffs regime. The president was not coy about using tariffs as the stick part of carrot and stick negotiations. Can you just get a little more specific about what the administration can now use as a stick?
Yeah, well, again, they have plenty of mechanisms that they can use. There's this Trade Act of 1974, which allows a 15% tariff for a period of up to 150 days, though there may be some restrictions for countries where the Americans are running a trade surplus. And then after that, you're going to see a bridge for country-specific Section 301 investigations on countries all over the map that would then be the mechanism that the president uses for tariffs after that 150-day period is over. And of course, there's already been a number of agreements that have occurred, which I don't think are going to be undone by those leaders just because the Supreme Court has ruled that Trump didn't have the right to put the tariffs on that he put on. Why? Because there's plenty of other things that the Americans can do if they're upset with you as a negotiating counterparty. So I don't see the Japanese now saying, wait a second, you negotiated with us under false pretenses, so we're not going to actually spend the money we said we're going to. That, I think, is very unlikely.
Trump's love and seeming determination to use tariffs is well known. Will his next moves to levy tariffs also go to the Supreme Court?
I don't think so, because, again, the other moves are the moves that were recommended by his economics team back in April and that he chose at the last minute because he was impatient and he didn't want it to take a long time and he didn't want it to be complicated. He chose not to listen. Now he's actually going to have to listen to his experts. You know, it turns out that a lot of the people that Trump has appointed on his economics team, on his foreign policy team, a lot of them are actually quite capable in terms of their policy background, but that doesn't mean that Trump is necessarily going to listen to him. And no matter how good your team is, if you decided that you know more than they do and you're not willing to actually listen or accept any countersway, any criticism, then the team's not going to be very effective.
Ian, still early hours after this decision, but do we have any reaction from how other countries see this ruling?
Well, I just spoke to the leader of one of the big multilaterals about half an hour ago, and that person was completely unsurprised. The markets haven't moved very much on this, which means the markets have long expected. The IEEPA ruling has taken some time to come out. There were rumors it was going to be a month ago, a couple weeks ago. But I think the markets understood that this was Trump acting to breach the law, and he was going to be constrained. So again, you know, from Trump's perspective, it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. But ultimately, the punishment comes. And the Supreme Court happens to be an independent branch of government, and it rules as such. I mean, if there's any surprise, it's that the ruling was only 6-3, it wasn't 9-0, because there's no real effective legal argument here that Trump did have the authority to levy these tariffs in place. And, you know, what we have seen in the past 2 months are a number of occasions where things that Trump thought he could get away with, turns out there was a lot of opposition. We saw that with his efforts to annex Greenland. We saw it with sending ICE into Minneapolis. We've seen it with Trump's announcements on wanting to nationalize or federalize elections in the midterms because he says they're rigged. And now we're seeing it with IEPA. And this is a significant number of Trump announcements and decisions that just aren't so.
So if his advisors are so smart, why didn't they tell him to use a 1974 law instead of the 1977 IEPA?
Look, it was very clear that they were trying to do that, as I said. I mean, and not all of the advisors were. I mean, Peter Navarro in the White House was the one that came up with this, let's just use this one mechanism, and here's the percentage, and here's how we levy tariffs on everybody. But as we know, this reminds me of the January 6th pardons. You know, Trump, as he was running for re-election, he said that he was only going to pardon some of them, not all of them, not the violent ones. Then he becomes president. And of course, the mechanism of actually executing those pardons becomes messy. And he has people lobbying him and giving him reasons why it should be this person, but not that person. And here's a reason why that's going to cause problems. And he's just sick of it. He doesn't like the details. And he finally says, that's it. We're just going to pardon everybody. And it doesn't matter what the consequences are. And that's what happened here, is he had, you know, a team of people that were arguing and bickering and negotiating over which countries should have which tariffs and what mechanisms. And here's why it shouldn't be on this country. And here's why it's going to hurt this industry. And, you know, instead, he grabbed onto the suggestion that here's how you can just announce there's going to be tariffs on everyone, and there's never been a president that's done it the way you have, sir, and Liberation Day is going to be the most extraordinary holiday, and we're going to celebrate it every year, and you can always do exemptions afterwards, and sounds great at the time, and then later on you find out that, yeah, you didn't really work that way.
So who benefits the most from today's decision? Like, are there countries in particular that were struggling more than others under the tariff regime struck down by the court?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Chinese, the Mexicans, the Canadians, probably they end up with more leverage in an ongoing trade negotiations process. I mean, USMCA is ongoing and needs to be re-upped. And the negotiations with the Chinese and the United States, we're going to have meetings, couple big meetings this year at least. And those are very live meetings. So I'd say they probably are the big winners. And the other winners, comparative winners, are the American consumers that won't have to pay as much in tariffs.
Are the relationships with those countries you just mentioned likely to be repaired or at least trend positively upward as a result of the Supreme Court ruling?
No, not at all. The reason that there's a challenge in these relationships is because they see the United States as less predictable and less reliable. And there's nothing about the Supreme Court ruling that fundamentally changes that in the near term.
What are you watching for next, Ian?
I'm just going to see sort of how quickly the president is able to move and on putting, you know, new tariffs in place that will ease the sting of this ruling. And also, of course, more immediately, you want to see how Trump responds to the Supreme Court itself. Does he try to argue that the Supreme Court itself is illegitimate, has acted against American national security, in some ways are unpatriotic? Would he make that argument directly? He's been very loath to take on the Supreme Court. You know, I mean, that's like touching a very hot stove. But you know, he's taken on the independent Fed, and he's gotten burned a couple times on that. That hasn't gone so well for him, but he keeps doing it. So let's see what he does on the Supreme Court.
That was Ian Bremmer, president of Eurasia Group, speaking with me today about the impact of the 6-3 Supreme Court ruling that Trump's emergency tariffs are not legal. Ahead on the show, Olympic highlights from a nail-biter of a year for hockey, and preparations are underway for the first night of Ramadan. But up next, in Iran, fears of war are intensifying. Stay tuned. You're with The World. This is the World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump today told reporters that he is considering a limited military strike on Iran if the country does not reach a nuclear deal. The president said he'll make a decision within the next 10 days. Meanwhile, Iran warned that it will respond in kind to any military aggression. All this uncertainty comes as many Iranians inside the country mark the customary 40 days of mourning after thousands were killed during anti-government protests last month. The World's Shirin Jafari has more.
Fathers, mothers, friends, and families gathered around the graves of the dead protesters this week. Videos shared online showed the families laying fresh flowers and weeping for the young lives taken by Iran's security forces last month. Many of the dead were young and educated, full of energy and rage against a government that they said has robbed them of a normal life. I would like everyone here to clap for my son, says the mother of 27-year-old Nima Parsa, who was killed by a bullet to his head. Many families are going against the traditional somber mourning rituals as a show of defiance against the government. They clap, dance, and play music as a celebration of the lives of their loved ones. Nima Parsa was an English and Italian instructor. He made videos like this one on YouTube and Instagram.
صفت لیبرو یعنی آزاد، خالی. چهار تا حالت میگیره. حالت اول.
His mom told the crowd at his gravesite that all her son did throughout his life was to study and teach. He gave his life for a better future, she said. This is the father of another killed protester, Hossein Mirkarimi. He addresses the security forces in an online video. Why did you kill my son, he asks. He didn't deserve to die. He was a hostage to this government and its policies. Thousands of people were killed last month in the protests, which were some of the biggest Iran has seen in recent years. Iranians from all walks of life went out to the streets to demand the fall of the government and removal of the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. Human rights groups say that the security forces killed thousands of people in response. The brutal crackdown that followed has left many in shock. 26-year-old Sara took part in the protests. She tells me that after what she has witnessed, life will never be the same for her. She says people my age want to see a change in this country, even if that means the start of that change is chaotic. I've reached the point where I feel like anything that gives me the slightest glimmer of hope, I am drawn to it, she says. Sara studies genetics in the southern city of Shiraz. She says despite investing in higher education, it would be unlikely for her to find a job when she graduates. She lives with her parents. Her father is a retired teacher. And she says the family can't afford basic necessities. It's this despair that sent me to the streets, she tells me. Over in the capital, Tehran, 37-year-old Hasti tells me she recently lost her job at a travel agency. She takes care of her elderly mother, who was recently diagnosed with lung cancer. This is a decisive moment for us, she says. We have paid a heavy price for demanding our freedom. She says it pains me to say that we are in a position to ask for outside help to get rid of this brutal government. But these leaders don't hesitate to kill their own people to stay in power. Iranians have been tracking the military buildup around their homeland for weeks. They've become familiar with names like U.S. carrier Abraham Lincoln and Gerald Ford. As the news about a possible imminent strike spread, some Iranians are taking to social media to share tips about how to stay safe.
یک، با خانواده برنامه اضطراری مشخص کنید. اگر از همدیگه جدا شدید،
prepare an emergency plan with your family, says Nikki Yagmoyi, a musician and content creator. Designate a meeting point in case you get separated. Stock up on dried goods and water, he says. Meanwhile, the government continues to punish protesters. The human rights organization Amnesty International said today that at least 30 people who allegedly took part in the protests faced the death penalty. It said three of them are minors. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
For North American hockey fans, this year's Olympic Games have been one for the history books. On the men's side, NHL teammates became rivals as nearly 150 pro players represented their home countries. This is the first time since the 2014 Games that the NHL has taken a break in its schedule to allow players to compete in the Olympics. Boston Bruins goaltender Jonas Korpisalo says he jumped at the chance after he was named to Team Finland.
Never know. It was the first or last, you know, for the NHL guys in the Olympics. And like I said, it might be a one-time opportunity.
Finland lost their semifinal matchup against Canada today, but remain hopeful for a bronze medal. On the women's side, there was no shortage of firsts and broken records. France competed for the first time ever. They came in last place in the tournament of 10 teams. Both of the women's finals went into overtime. Sweden and Switzerland played for bronze yesterday. Both scored just one goal during regulation play. Then, with under a minute remaining in overtime, Swiss powerhouse Alina Mueller found the back of the net.
Mueller for Faye. Back for Mueller! She scores! It's hardware for Switzerland and heartbreak for Sweden.
Yeah, a victory that harkens back to 2014's bronze medal match, also between Switzerland and Sweden, when a 15-year-old Mueller scored the game-winning goal to become the youngest hockey player to ever win an Olympic medal. Yesterday, the U.S. and Canada faced off for the gold. Their rivalry was as heated as ever, with Canada scoring first. The score stayed 1-0 until the final 2 minutes, when Team USA captain Hillary Knight tied it up, allowing teammate Megan Keller to secure the gold in overtime.
Pass for Keller, a defenseman. Nice move. Cuts to the net. Score! Megan Keller, the overtime hero. The United States wins gold in Milan.
The U.S. were favored to win, but nobody expected it to be that close. Canada's captain Marie-Philippe Poulin had this to say on the loss.
Sadly, we came out short, but I don't think it was a surprise. Canada-U.S. in overtime in a gold medal game. It can't go either way, and sadly, we came out short.
But Poulin goes home with a record of her own, the most goals scored in an Olympic career. Her two goals in the semifinal game against Switzerland brought her total to 20, surpassing the previous record of 18. When you think about the priorities around the future of energy on the planet, you might think climate change would be way high up on the list. Well, that list just came out, and climate change is not on it. That conversation is ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
The Muslim call to prayer today at the Grand Mosque in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, on the first Friday prayers of this year's observance of Ramadan. This week, millions of Muslims across the world have begun a month of fasting, prayer, and reflection. Ramadan is an important time of the year for Ekhlas Ahmed and her family. Ahmed was just 12 years old when she fled her home in Darfur in Sudan because of the violent conflict there. They found refuge here in the U.S. and in 2006 resettled in Portland, Maine. Darfur still carries painful memories for her, but it was also her home for many years, and Ekhlas Ahmed also recalls times without violence, and one particular night of Ramadan when fasting back home in Darfur did not seem to end. She shared the memory with GBH's Stories from the Stage.
The day before Ramadan is usually a hectic one for everyone in Sudan, but especially for my family. The thing is, my mother waits until the last second to shop for 30 days worth of food. So yes, I was not surprised when I found myself at 1 a.m. shopping for Ramadan food. My brothers get to sleep in, but here I am. My feet were so tired. I was so exhausted, but most definitely so hungry. In Ramadan, you have to eat right before the sun comes up. So I wanted to make sure I get home on time. We waited for taxi after taxi after taxi, and finally, we found one. The second we got into the taxi, we heard the call for prayer, the azan, and we knew it was too late. We did not make it home on time before we can eat to fast for the next day. So that night, I went to bed on a hungry stomach. It's okay. I woke up on the first day so excited about Ramadan. Ramadan is my favorite Islamic holiday because we get to be together with family and friends, and I get to cook in the kitchen with my mom. So we got in the kitchen, we start cooking our favorite Ramadan food. My mom got to cook her favorite lentil soup with all of her spices. I got to cook the okra dish for my dad, the potato for my brothers. We were happy. The tradition in Sudan is that you place all the food right before the sunset, right on the ground, so the family can join in the circle and enjoy the meal together. So that's exactly what my mother and I did. 15 minutes before we can eat. All I was thinking about was all the delicious food that was waiting. My brother, who was taking a shower, and he was sleeping all day, and now he got up to take a shower, suddenly came running so fast and tripped on the food that we just cooked for 6.5 hours. He got a second degree burn on half of his body. So I wasn't thinking about the food. I was rushing with my mother and my siblings to the ER because we were concerned. We got to the ER. There was no food there. My family lives so far away, so nobody could get us anything so we can break our fast. We waited and waited and waited. I feel like it was a century that we were in that hospital. And finally, the doctor came out. He said we could go home. And yes, I was going to be able to eat after 3 days of waiting. We got in the car. My dad drove and drove and drove and drove. I was thinking about the lentil soup, the potato dish. I was thinking about the okra. And I slept in the back of my dad's truck. I was quickly awoken by the sound of adhan again. It was 5 a.m. and we have missed our chance to eat before fasting. It's been 4 days. I knew that Ramadan was all about sacrificing to feel the hunger, to feel what it means to be hungry, but this one was just way too much, especially for my stomach. Thank you.
Ekhlas Ahmed there from GBH's Stories from the Stage. Don't wait to shop in Ramadan Mubarak. The International Energy Agency has announced its priorities for the next 2 years, and one phrase is glaringly absent from the list: climate change. That is a significant reversal. It's also something one country in particular had been pushing for. That would be the U.S. Kate Guy is an expert in the geopolitics of energy at Columbia University. She previously worked on climate change and foreign policy with the U.S. State Department under the Biden administration. When we spoke today, she explained the purpose of the International Energy Agency and why this omission matters.
So it's one of those international institutions, sort of like the United Nations, where countries can come together and debate issues and try to coordinate and set policy together, in this case, specifically around energy. And it was established back in the 1970s in response then to the oil crisis. Then over the years, you know, the global energy economy has really changed dramatically. And with that, the mandate of the IEA, what countries come together to talk about and set policy on, has also broadened beyond just focusing on oil to the full energy economy.
So for the past decade, what would you say has been like the headline of the general thrust of the IEA?
Yeah, so for the past decade in particular, so that's, 2015 on forward, countries have been operating under the Paris Agreement on climate change and the goals set under that. So countries have used the IEA, and the IEA sort of expanded its work, its research, its analysis to look not just at, global energy security or oil security, but actually at the energy transition, how to help countries, as you said, transition their energy use from fossil fuel dominated supply and demand to a more renewable, decarbonized, net zero future. So a lot of the work really expanded to clean energy finance and technology and sort of critical minerals that are important for clean energy technologies and all of the host of issues that countries really want to and need to coordinate on for the energy transition.
So what exactly happened at this meeting?
So at this most recent meeting, it's a ministerial, so each country sends their top energy minister, and this was actually the largest meeting ever, which just shows how many countries see it as really critical and important to be at this table and talk about energy issues, given everything that's happening in the world right now. And so at the meeting, countries sort of sat down and tried to decide, what can we work on together and what can we not? And the United States sort of came into those meetings with a very different position than it had had in previous meetings, but honestly really consistent with what we've seen from the Trump administration so far, where they are taking a very anti-climate approach and really said this body, the IEA generally, the work that it does should no longer focus on climate change, should no longer have analysis on the energy transition or decarbonization, and we should really strike that from the work of the IEA going forward. And so you saw countries grappling with that, trying to figure out where they disagree, but also where they can continue to work together on energy issues going forward. And as you say, ultimately, countries are not able to agree on a joint statement, which you would normally see coming out of one of these meetings and one of these ministerials. But there were other issues that countries agreed to work on, like critical minerals, supply chains, and energy security, which is top of mind for many countries.
Why is it important to the workings of the IEA whether or not climate change is explicitly listed as a priority?
Yeah, well, to that point, 2 years ago, climate change and specifically transitioning our energy and our economies away from fossil fuel use was actually held up by the IEA, agreed to as one of the top priorities. So this is a really big shift to say something goes from like something we're really all focused on together as our top priority to not even on the menu. That's a really big shift. And what that means is the IEA, in addition to sort of hosting these meetings where countries can gather, they also do a lot of analysis, a lot of data collection, put out a lot of reports. Their seminal report each year is the World Energy Outlook that all governments, but also all business, all investors, everyone in the economy sort of looks to that data and those scenarios to make choices about the future, to say, where are we going to invest our money? What do we think is coming around the bend? What is most likely to happen in energy in the next few years? And that analysis is really critical to those decisions that leaders make. And so if the U.S. and other signals are putting pressure, we don't want decarbonization to be part of that analysis. We don't want climate change to even be something that you look at. Well, necessarily, that's going to shift that analysis, shift the scenarios that the IEA uses, and then potentially shift decisions that leaders make all up and down that chain.
So, I mean, just practically, does that mean that there are new priorities now?
Yeah. So the priorities that the countries were able to agree on were mostly around energy security. And this makes a lot of sense because you see, rising energy use, rising electrification, AI and data center growth. The other issue that we will see countries work on more is looking at critical minerals like silicon, like cobalt, that are important inputs into batteries, into clean energy technology. And just the sort of need for these critical minerals as an input is really important for countries to work together on because the supply chains are so constrained.
I'm speaking with Kate Guy, an expert in the geopolitics of energy at Columbia University. Why was the U.S. pushing for this? I mean, is it obvious?
Well, no. I mean, it's a big shift, right? And it has been sort of like whiplash for many countries around the world to watch the United States change its position so dramatically. Obviously, under the Biden administration, addressing the climate challenge, moving to a clean energy economy was some of the top priorities that President Biden had diplomatically. And so you had many countries working together with the United States to pursue those goals. With the Trump administration, they came in and they didn't just take a milder position on that. They really have adopted an anti-climate position globally. So they will sort of come into international negotiations like these at the International Energy Agency and say, not only, do we not want to work on climate, we actually, want any sort of emphasis on that removed, any funding for that removed, and put really aggressive tactics to those policies and those interests. And that's not just a break from, the Biden administration. That's a break from the policies of the Bush administration. Many Republican administrations before that still saw and would pay lip service to the need to work on climate change, even if they didn't make it as a top priority. And so, countries around the world are seeing the U.S. backtrack from its commitments. And that's quite difficult and quite stunning for them to then figure out, well, how do we keep working on this thing that we've all said is really critical, one of the top defining global challenges, if one big and very important country to global energy and the global economy is now, actually turning the screws on us and saying we can't work on that.
So I gathered there was some resistance from other countries. What happened there?
Definitely, yes. So I heard from, my counterparts, my former counterparts who are on the ground, particularly European countries, but not just, many emerging economies as well. They still understand that climate change is threatening their economies more and more with each passing year, but also that there's huge economic incentive to move towards a more clean and renewable future. At the same time, I think what we see from the reporting and from what happened on the ground is they really felt the need to placate the United States in this really aggressive position. It's at one point the Trump administration was threatening to leave the IEA to, take its ball and go home if they didn't get what language they wanted. So, countries placate and diplomats will be diplomatic. But at the end of the day, most countries, especially China, Europe, and others, understand that an energy transition to renewable energy is their future. That makes sense for them economically, and they'll continue to work on that.
Kate, what does all this indicate to you about the wider political views on the energy transition now that we're in 2026?
Well, I mean, on the first hand, it shows that despite, one country saying this is really important, this is critical, this is the way we're moving, that can shift dramatically. And I think we've seen that with many geopolitical issues. The Trump administration is immediately turning tack and taking a really different approach. And that's leaving a lot of uncertainty for the global economy, for global politics more broadly, and just, for trust. And how can other countries trust anything the United States says if it's going to very quickly shift its position with any new president? So that's really tough. I think what it also shows increasingly is you have some countries going in one direction and other countries going in another direction. My colleagues at Columbia University have called this the electrostate versus petrostate divide. And you have some countries, China, Europe, many other developing economies as well, saying our future is in clean technologies, is in electricity, is in producing the jobs and the inputs that go into an increasingly clean, decarbonized economy. And you have other countries where they're sort of doubling down on a fossil fuel powered economy. And that's a really big divide emerging on the global stage. And the Trump administration is really often leading the pack now in negotiations on that petrostate perspective.
Wow, electrostate versus petrostate, that kind of sums it up. And the fundamental problem being that carbon emissions do not respect borders. So where do things go from here with these divergent paths you just described?
That's a really good point, because the backdrop to all of this, to all of the negotiations and all of the meetings and all of the diplomacy is the science, right? And is what's happening in the world. And with each passing year, we see greenhouse gas emissions, those, heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, which just, increase the global temperature more and more on that dial with each passing year, they're continuing to rise. And that's unfortunately, despite a lot of good efforts, that's despite renewable energy and clean energy technology technologies dramatically being reduced in price and really dramatically being an uptake in their use, even still, especially with, you know, the build out of artificial intelligence and the energy demand there and across the economy, we're seeing those greenhouse gas emissions still rise. So a lot of people are seeing this as, you know, a step back from even where we need to go, that we're, you know, not on track for. And unfortunately, you know, a reality where climate change is going to cause that many more extreme and persistent impacts into the future.
Yeah, and you kind of leaned into this just a moment ago. How worried are you that as the U.S. continues down that petrostate path, other countries will just throw their hands up in the air and say, all right, yeah, fossil fuels, gimme?
Yeah, I am worried about it because I think, you know, the science demands that we move as fast as we possibly can. This is not going to be an immediate or a fast transition. And steps we take now or steps we do not take now can just mean another tenth of a degree of temperature rise, which has huge implications for lives and livelihoods around the world. At the same time, you know, I think increasingly the analysis is pointing towards countries like China, despite being the largest global emitter, despite, you know, a ton of fossil fuel use, particularly coal, to power their economy, they believe by mid-century, by the end of the century, the world is moving to a more electrified, clean energy-powered world, particularly with the huge increasing demand from artificial intelligence. They are making the calculation that will be powered likely not by fossil fuels, but by renewable energy technologies. And so what really worries me as an American, as someone who cares about the American economy and American jobs, is our competitiveness, right? And how we are competing with the economy of China and others if we've sort of doubled down on the energy sources of the past and instead sort of ceded that innovation edge to China and to our competitors.
Kate Guy joined us from Columbia University, where she is managing director of the Geopolitics of Climate Change and the Energy Transition. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A court case in Austria has sparked international debate about the responsibility of mountain climbers for their climbing partners. A judge handed down a guilty verdict this week for a man the courts are calling Thomas P., who left his girlfriend to freeze to death near the summit of Austria's highest alpine peak.
The couple wanted to climb Großglockner via a difficult route, the so-called Stüdelgrat, and the weather that day was nasty.
That's Antonia Rout, a journalist for De Standard. She's covered this case in a podcast.
The attempt was a difficult one from the beginning.
Antonia joined us from Vienna to discuss the verdict. She started by explaining what happened to the couple.
Their tour started in the early morning on January 18th last year, and it ended around 4 o'clock in the morning with only Thomas P. coming back to the valley. His 33-year-old girlfriend, Kerstin G., died of hypothermia close to the peak.
You are from Tyrol, as I said, the region of Austria where all this took place. What sort of climbing skills are needed to summit this particular path up Großglockner?
Well, it's definitely more than a hike. So it's advanced climbing. There's also videos of that route on YouTube. So people might want to check that out. You get a pretty good picture of how advanced you have to be. And you also have to say it's a lot of altitude you have to climb in one day. So it's a really, really heavy piece of hiking you do there.
What did prosecutors argue in this case in court?
They said that he was the far more experienced one of the two. And so it was in his responsibility to decide that they should have stopped the attempt around a certain point, because it's kind of a point of no return. And in fact, after that point, they got into troubles. And because they didn't return earlier, that might have been why she died there.
So what was the Austrian law that basically underpinned the prosecutor's case?
So if two people go on a hike or a tour together and one of them is far more experienced, he is the guide, even if he's not a professional guide in that way. And that is a very specific law that hasn't been in use a lot before. And so it's kind of a precedent case as well.
But that is striking, that there is a law in Austria that is looking specifically at mountaineering and that the most experienced climber in the group has responsibility for the least experience. Is that correct?
It's in the alpine scene in Austria, a verdict that's been discussed a lot now. Experts say that it shouldn't make people too nervous because as long as you're taking responsibility and really trying to figure out situations carefully, it shouldn't affect you.
So that's what underpinned the court's decision. But the prosecutors also found that this man made a series of bad mistakes, right?
Yeah, you can say so. There were like 9 mistakes listed, although the judge didn't see all of them really happening. But you could say some of the very important ones were that they did the tour at all because she was not experienced enough, the court said, for a tour like that.
Mm.
And also that there wasn't a call for emergency at a point when it got dark and there was even a helicopter looking for them at some point, and they didn't give it signals, like proper signals, if they needed help or not.
Those seem like really fundamental errors. The court handed the defendant a 5-month suspended sentence and fined him over $11,000. It's a guilty verdict, but he can still appeal, and there's a possibility he may be ultimately let off. Is that right?
Exactly. On the one hand, a surprising decision because there haven't been a lot of guilty sentences in that way, but it has also been clear to many people that he wouldn't have been sent to prison.
I'm speaking with journalist Antonio Raut in Vienna about a recent case there that caught a lot of attention, about a mountaineer who left his girlfriend in a precarious situation on a mountaintop while he went to get help. She ultimately froze to death. Antonio, a lot of people mountain climb in Austria. The judge was himself an experienced mountaineer. So how typical a situation is this? I can imagine tragedies like this are not uncommon in the Austrian Alps.
Unfortunately, they aren't. And I think we have to say that not a lot of people will come to a situation like this fatal. But a lot of people who have ever been to the mountains know that, for example, weather conditions can change very quickly and you just have to make decisions based on your environment and also on the group you are hiking with. And it is definitely a case that's brought back to mind that in the mountains, climbing, but also just hiking, you really, really should stay on the safe side always.
Well, you're kind of edging into what I was going to ask you next, which is, since you're from this area, Antonia, what are the best practices when you're planning to go up a mountain like this? Are there certain things you should always bring or remember?
Well, preparation is key. Also, you have to really check your gear. You have to know your gear. Weather conditions are key. So that's all stuff that you should be informed of. And like in best practice, you would learn it in courses by specific alpine schools or the Alpenverein. So education is also key in the mountains. Hiking isn't something that just comes to you naturally just because you can walk.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, as you mentioned, there were things that should have been done that might have made a difference in the fate of this woman. At the same time, though, nature is unforgiving. We can think about how on Everest there are cases where people need to be left behind because the whole group could die trying to rescue a single person. So what is the general understanding of those ethical calculations in the mountaineering community?
I spoke to an experienced mountaineer about leaving someone behind, and he said that there are very, very few cases where you might have to do that. For example, if you are in danger yourself or if you have to call for emergency and you, for example, don't have service. But normally, and especially in winter, leaving someone behind should really, really not happen. Like, you should stay with people. You should try to keep them moving and even also try to warm them up if they can't move further. That's a very tricky one. But you also have to say it's very hard to talk about decisions people make in extreme conditions like this.
Antonia, with this mountain climb, with mountaineering, isn't toughness part of what people are out trying to prove?
Toughness is kind of required, but it shouldn't be taking risks, so it might be your last peak. That's what a mountaineer said to me.
I mean, psychologically, do some mountaineers feel like if they have to call for help, they failed?
It's always hard to say okay, I brought myself into a situation that I can't handle anymore. But I guess failure would be if you die because you can't say, okay, I made a mistake.
And that was Antonia Rout, a journalist with Der Standard, who covered the case of the guilty mountaineer in a podcast. She joined us from Vienna. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
PRX. From PRX.